Thank you for the very kind introduction. I'm not sure how much smiling I was doing, but maybe it was just gas or something. I'm uncertain. So today I'm going to talk about higher-order corrections to the KdV approximation for water waves. And this is joint work I did with Gene Wayne while I was a graduate student at Boston University. So thank you, Gene. So first I'll go through an outline. I know I'm in a room full of experts, but I'm going to start slow. I'm going to talk about what is the KdV approximation. And then I'm going to talk about why it's a really great approximation. Because, I mean, we all know it's a great approximation already. But then I'm going to talk about things that maybe go wrong with when you use the KdV to approximate various nonlinear dispersive systems. I'm going to talk about a means by which we came up to fix these problems to maybe get a more accurate model. And then I'm going to show you some samples of some numerics I did a few years ago that sort of indicate, you know, exactly what's going on. So that's where we're going to go. And now, before we go anywhere, I have to tell you sort of what problem we're looking at. So we're looking at the problem of a water wave in a two-dimensional canal. So what we have here is we have gravity acting downward. We have a canal that I'm just going to take to be one unit deep. We're mathematicians, so we don't have units, right? So gravity has acceleration due to gravity is 1. The channel is of depth 1. And we have a free surface that evolves in time. And we're going to work today in Lagrangian coordinates. And so this is primarily because when you prove theorems, it's easier to do things in Lagrangian coordinates. But it's a little less intuitive, so I just want to sort of describe what's going on here. So the free surface is just a parameterized curve in the plane. So it's just like a Calc 2 sort of object with parameters x and y. I'm going to parameterize the x-coordinate in a sort of funny way, alpha plus x alpha t, sort of to get the idea that it looks like a graph maybe, just sort of to enforce that notion. And the parameter the parameter functions will change over time. In addition to this just being a parameterized curve, it also has a physical meaning, which is that at time t, so it's, we're basically tracing the flow of an individual particle. So if I have particle alpha, so who is initially at alpha plus x alpha comma 0 comma y alpha comma 0, so that was particle alpha's initial position, then it time t, that particle is at, in space coordinates, these 2 points. So this is following around particle alpha. So I'll probably talk about my buddy particle alpha a couple of times during the talk. So these are sort of not the most intuitive coordinates you've ever seen. More or less, we're going to think about y as being the surface elevation. Okay, so at any point, if you get really confused or not confused or whatever, just think of y as being the surface elevation. So if you set the problem up in this way, and you consider a fluid which is incompressible with irrotational flow, inviscid, no surface tension, this sort of standard situation, the water wave equation looks like this. And I'll sort of explain each of the equations in this for a second. The first line here, if you squint at it hard enough, it's just Newton's law. It's just Euler's equation. It's set up in these funny coordinates, but, you know, it's got an acceleration dt squared x here, and then this one here is really g, as it turns out. But it's the same Euler's equation you've seen evaluated on the free surface. The other big equation in when you're talking about water waves in a two-dimensional canal or just ever, that's incompressible or rotational is Laplace's equation. We've removed that from the problem because we're not talking about a flow on a we're not talking about anything in the domain any longer because we restrict ourselves to the surface. But this operator K you see here is sort of the remnant of the Laplace's equation. It's called the Hilbert transform sometimes. Sometimes it's related to the Dirichlet-Neumann map. More or less, it gives the relationship between the velocity in the horizontal direction on the free surface to the velocity in the vertical direction. And I'll talk more about this. Probably not too much. It's quite complicated, and you can spend your whole life just thinking about it, which would be a great way to spend your life. So maybe I'll Now, just also, because my numerics at the end are going to be for a slightly different problem, I should at least tell you what the that equation is. When we started working on this problem, we initially considered this Boussinesq system, which we considered mainly because it's much simpler to deal with, and we wanted to sort of come up with a toy model problem. This equation here is itself a model equation for water waves, and it was developed by Boussinesq. And so the KdV equation also approximates solutions to this problem in much the same way it will for the water wave problem. So generally, you can think of any theorem I say about water waves will be more or less true for this problem as well. I'm really only showing it to you now so that when I spring it on you later on in the talk, you don't feel cheated. So, also, just in general, this is a model equation, and you should think of theta as being the surface elevation, just like y was. Okay. Okay, so this is the setup for the KdV approximation, which was developed by Kordaveg and DeVries and also by Boussinesq. So they were looking for solutions to this problem over here, which had long wavelength, were small in amplitude, moved in one direction, and didn't change their shape very much. That is to say, they were looking for solitary waves. So they looked for these, and they, well, this is not how they did it, but this is how I'll do it, or at least how I'll motivate it. Don't need that slide. So they make the following ansatz about the surface elevation, about why. That it's small in amplitude, so I introduce a small parameter epsilon, and I introduce a function u, which is in a moving reference frame to the right, which I'm going to call that coordinate beta minus. I scale it with an epsilon out in front, so it's long wavelength. If I was looking for a traveling wave, I would just stop there, but I'm thinking maybe it'll change a little bit as time goes on, so I'm going to introduce a really slow time scale, epsilon cubed times t, which I'm going to call capital T, as we move along, and that's the sort of solution I'm looking for, something that's low in amplitude, long in wavelength, moves along. Just for yucks, I'm going to introduce a leftward moving function too. This is not necessarily what they did, but you can do it and just see what happens. And then you're assuming that your equation y is more or less these epsilon squared terms plus something order epsilon to the fourth, standard sort of ansatz that is made. You do a lot of algebra, which I won't trouble you with, and you find that the water wave equation to highest order can be solved by taking u and v to, okay, so ignore these chicken scratches on here from the last time I gave this talk. I apologize, I didn't have time to erase those. You find that these guys solve KdV equations, which you can, if you squint your eyes, you can take them to be uncoupled, which will squint for the time being. So that's more or less the origin of the KdV equation. So we're going to now talk about what this seems to say. So we want to talk about what sort of predictions we get out of this. But before we do that, I want to talk about a theorem that was proved by Guido Schneider and Gene Wayne in 2000 that says that you can do this rigorously. But this is not just hand waving. This is formal estimates. So more or less their theorem says if you start out with good initial data, whatever that means, basically long wavelength, small amplitude, and also this initial other condition of sort of rapid polynomial-like decay, then the solution to the water wave equation satisfies an estimate that looks like this. So W bar is, so really just stare at the middle coordinate here, y. Talk about the other two in a second. You take y and you subtract off the ansatz. You measure that in an appropriate Sobolev space, and that's quite small. So it's order epsilon to the 7/2. We had guessed it was going to be order epsilon to the 4th. The loss of a half derivative is just due to the long wavelength scaling, so there's nothing fishy going on with that loss of a derivative. We also get, in the same process, we get approximations for the alpha derivative of that coordinate function x, which looks much like the y approximation. And we also get a approximation for x sub t, which is more or less you think of that as being the horizontal velocity of the surface at the point alpha. And so it also evolves according to these sort of KdV-like, or these KdV equations. So the point here about the theorem is, well, twofold. Is one, you can consider these sort of uncoupled equations, and you don't lose any size, and you don't lose any accuracy in the order of your approximation by having uncoupled, counterpropagating KdV trains. All right, at least not to the, you don't lose any accuracy at the order that you expected initially. So that's sort of a nice effect. So that's this is the sort of theorem that you see a lot of times in these sort of problems. And then just to say this, you can prove an entirely analogous theorem for the Boussinesq equation. This is a result of Guido Schneider from 1998. His techniques weren't as sophisticated as the ones that he and Jean developed for the water wave equation, but so he only got a 3 here. You can go back to his argument and make that a 7/2 too. So more or less, this is the same theorem that you just saw, but just for the KdV equation with the counterpropagating things and everything. Yes. Mm-hmm. It is enough to see solitons interacting in both directions, yeah. So I'll talk about this a little more in a second, but more or less head-on collisions occur rapidly because these things are moving with more or less unit velocity. Right. The if you go back to the scaling, the KdV equation evolves on this. Let me just go back to show you these KdV equations. This is a good opportunity to mention this. Capital T here was epsilon cubed T. So order one times for KdV are very long times for the original problem. And so in particular, the solitons interactions occur on times of order one in KdV. And so you can translate that back to the original problem without any trouble. So, all right. So hopefully I haven't totally disastrously disorganized my lecture notes here. Okay. So now let's talk about, so I'm going to make the same joke I always make here in a second, so just prepare yourself to laugh with me. So first I make the remark, which is that KdV equations possess these explicit solitary solutions, which are these famous set squared solutions. And so formally all this proves that we have solitary waves in a canal. Not a real proof, but it's close enough for, when you're in the 1800s, I guess. So it's pretty wonderful stuff. Here's the remark. This is a joke I stole from my advisor. So remarkable is that this result tells you more than just that solitary waves exist. It's a result for general initial data. Okay, so more or less any of the initial data that you prepare to be long wavelength, small amplitude is going to evolve like KdV. So, you got more than just solitary waves, and you got more than just interacting solitons. You sort of see all sorts of different things. And so, in particular, you're going to see these multi-soliton solutions that we just had a question about. And so this sort of behavior has, in fact, been observed. In particular, there's some experiments that were just done quite recently at Penn State where they actually did some very nice multi-soliton sort of like collisions for water waves. So Joe Hammack and Diane Anderson did that. It's very exciting stuff. All right, so that's the remarkable. And then this is the joke I make. Remarkable-est is that if you perform the same sort of analysis as Boussinesq and Kordovec de Vries on a number of other nonlinear dispersive systems, you still see KdV. These systems include the Euler-Poisson model for plasma dynamics and the Fermi-Pasdaoula model of atomic interactions. In particular, there's been a lot of really nice work done by David Sattinger and some collaborators on this model, and so which is they have a very nice paper where they do a lot of numerics on that. So, all right, so that's my joke, and nobody laughs, and so I'll try not to be too depressed. I know, I'm sorry. Laugh for me. Okay, so.
defined potentials of perturbations they consider you have in mind? Is it one or?
Gene can probably answer this better than I can. I think it's anything that's looks like a Yeah, I believe the result is for a certain general potential that's a that's got a well at the origin or however you say. So. Okay. So let's talk about what KDV predicts. I just want to remind you what this thing won't go off now, so I don't want to burn anybody's eyes out. I'm just going to write down what the ansatz again. I'm just going to leave that there for the remainder of the talk. So the KDV, what kind of predictions do we get from this sort of theorem? First of all, we get solitary waves like we talked about. You can go through and you can compute what the velocity of those waves is. It's 1 plus epsilon squared times c. You can see multi-solitons, as we discussed. In that case, you just say u equal to the KDV multi-soliton. You said v equal to 0. But then you also see counterpropagating collisions of waves. If you set u equal to the a soliton and v equal to a soliton, then what you're going to get is you're going to get, I wish this thing would shut off. I'm feeling a little bit bad about it. All right, I'll just put it over there. So you have these two waves coming at each other. More or less, they are going to evolve not very much at all because it's a short-time interaction. And they're going to collide, and then they're going to add linearly, right? This is a, according to the approximation, this is a linear, up to the order that you see, this is just a linear superposition. So you should see a collision that where 1 plus 1 equals 2, right? So that's, thank you. So that's the sort of behaviors you can sort of expect to see. And so let me tilt this a little bit better. So the KDV approximation seems to be pretty ideal, right? I mean, it predicts a lot of things. KDV is explicitly solvable and has lots of a million great properties. And it does a good job, according to the theorem of Schneider and Wayne. But there are certain problems that you observe if you actually look at the models, at the actual physical systems that it models. The first one is sort of related to this bit with the interactions between counterpropagating waves, which is that if you collide waves going head-on in water in a water tank, and I should have brought my videotape that has a picture of this, and it totally I forgot to do so. When they collide, you don't get 1 plus 1 equals 2, you get 1 plus 1 equals 2 plus a little bit more. All right, so somehow, during a collision of water waves, there's some process that happens that increases the amplitude by a little bit. Not too much, but you can observe it with the naked eye if you have high enough amplitude waves. And if you have really high-tech measuring systems, you can observe it in low amplitude waves, too. So that's sort of what you're going to see. I'm also going to make this remark, but I'm not going to talk about it very much, which is that you also have a phase shift in head-on collisions, which is quite small, but numerics indicate that it's sort of the waves get stuck during the collision. They get held up during while they interact, and then they leave more or less with the same velocities. So that's, oops. So I'm going to skip that slide. Another sort of problem that you'll have is you'll have trouble that I call unidirectional trouble, which is that the solid, like if you just put in the sort of KDV initial conditions into a wave tank or a numerics, the water wave will form a dispersive wave behind a little ripple that's small in amplitude but sort of moves in the same direction. So I'm going to call this a unidirectional problem, and I'll leave it at that. So a similar problem with as the unidirectional problem is that you have this phase shift. There's the famous phase shift in the KDV multi-solitons, right? And there's also a phase shift in water wave solitons or multi-solitons that you observe in Poisson systems. Unfortunately, While you see the phase shift in all these systems, the KdV approximation doesn't quite get it right. It gets it's a little too I believe it's too small in water waves. So in other words, the phase shift should be size delta, and in water waves it's delta over like times 3/4 or something like that. I don't know the exact numbers. And so this is a particularly sort of troubling problem, right? Because it's, well, maybe not troubling, but it's there's really something different going on here, I think. And this is, I think, sort of maybe one of the harder ones to understand. But we forge on ahead, and we're just going to do the best we can. So the goal of our work was to derive sort of some equations which are going to correct for these sorts of problems. We want to be as nice as KdV as we can. We want to be as close to being as good as KdV as we can. In other words, we want it to be simple to write down. We'd like to be able to solve things explicitly if we can. And we'd like things to be independent of epsilon, at least at some level. Like KdV, there's no epsilon in that equation, so it's sort of good across a range of small, but still a range of scales. So we want to sort of preserve these sort of qualities. We don't want to come up with a model that's so complicated that you can't, you know, it's just as hard as the water wave problem in its own right. So this is how we do it. We're just going to go ahead, sort of very, proceed gaily forward, I guess. So we're going to just add new functions. We're going to just add more things over here. We have this order epsilon to the fourth thing here, so I'm just going to put stuff in here, and I'm going to see what it evolves according to. So what functional form should I put in here? So to fix for the unidirectional problems, I'm just going to pick the same exact form as for the KdV problem, right? I mean, why not? See if it works. So I'm going to pick a term f that corrects for the right moving stuff, and a term g that moves for the left moving stuff, and I'm just going to scale it 2 powers of epsilon higher than we initially started out with. So hopefully that'll work out for us. So then what are we going to do for the counter-propagating errors? We don't expect those things to be moving in a particular direction because it's correcting for counter-propagating sort of things. And so we don't want to put it in a moving reference frame, so I'm going to have a stationary reference frame, or, I don't know, a non-moving reference frame, but also of long wavelength, epsilon alpha. Because these waves are roughly of wavelength 1 over epsilon, and they're moving more or less with unit velocity, we expect a collision of these waves to take place on the time scale of 1 over epsilon. So I introduce a short time scale compared to the long time scale of KdV, but it's a long time scale compared to physical coordinates, epsilon t, which I'll just occasionally refer to as tau, and I'll occasionally refer to this as beta. Epsilon alpha is going to be beta. Okay, so if I make this assumption, and I make an ansatz, okay, and for technical reasons, this ansatz works much better if I approximate the alpha derivative, or minus the alpha derivative of the x function instead of y, but that's just a technicality. I make an ansatz that looks like this. So it looks exactly like this one, except I have these three extra terms, and then I expect an order epsilon to the sixth error. So what happens, if you insert this into your water wave equation, you do a lot of formal analysis and you throw out a lot of terms that you consider to be too big, you get these three equations. P satisfies a wave equation with an inhomogeneous term, which is driven, and the inhomogeneous term comes from the KdV approximation. All right? So this is doing exactly what we set it up to do. Right? We set it up to correct for interaction between these right and left moving waves, and you can't get much more of an interaction than whenever you multiply things together. So it's doing exactly what we hope. For the F and G, sort of unsurprisingly, you get inhomogeneous and linearized KdV equations. And in fact, they're linearized around the KdV solutions for the that you have for the KdV part. These J minus and J plus, I'm not going to show them to you because they're, you know, that long when you write them out. But they're just product sums, derivatives and of U and V, and also P. So if you really want to look at it, I can show it to you later on. So these are nice equations, right? I claim that these are more or less satisfy the what I had hoped to. Let me actually switch. Put that there. And put that there. Maybe that's a better way to do this. These are nice equations. Both of these are explicitly solvable. The wave equation is easily solvable just by method of characteristics. The linear SKDV can be explicitly solved as well by techniques related to inverse scattering that were developed by Bob Sachs a long time ago and then sort of refined more recently by David Sadger once again with some of his collaborators. Obviously, the method of characteristics in one dimension isn't the hardest thing you've ever done, but this is a fairly complicated business, and so I don't know anybody who's ever actually put this method into actual use. But at least you can do it. They're both easy to solve numerically as well. There's not much difficulty there. We also have a sort of a little proposition that says the solutions to these equations. They may not exist for all times, and maybe they grow, but they don't grow so bad for the long times that we consider. So in particular, we have this theorem that says that so these norms are in HS, where S is sufficiently high, that on these long time scales, these things don't get above some constant that doesn't depend on epsilon. Okay. So in particular, these equations here are gonna sort of just grow. At least linearly in time, but on the time scale they don't get too bad. That's sort of our point. So that's sort of, if you really wanted to get on my case, you would say, well, and since this is a Hamiltonian systems sort of conference, you would say, well, you start out with a Hamiltonian system. Now you don't have a Hamiltonian system anymore, which is pretty bad. You don't have energy conservation in the system at all. But the point is that it doesn't. You don't. The energy conservation isn't. You don't lose very much of it with these equations. Sort of another way to state that. Okay. Well, the water wave equation is, but these KdV is too. But these guys are not. Right? I mean, since they have inhomogeneous terms, they're just not gonna be Hamiltonian. Not much you can do about it. You can come up with. They are kind of coupling terms, but they're sort of coming down from above. Sort of, they don't feed, and F and G don't feed back into the above ones. So they're. No, even then it's still not. Well, I mean, KdV you have to throw out, so you have to just consider. Yeah, it's up to the error, I think, roughly, that you have there. So another way to, I mean, if you want to do this in any other number of ways, and this is, so a lot of people do come up with Hamiltonian models for long waves or any sort of waves, right? And so what they do is they write down the Hamiltonian, you know, and they write it as H0 plus H1 plus H2, and then, okay, how accurate do you want it to be? You truncate this at some point, right? Your Hamiltonian has some sort of, whatever, some sort of expansion, and so you sort of truncate that. And now you have some system that's not water waves anymore, but now it's maybe, you know, I'm sweeping a lot of stuff under the rug here, but maybe something that looks like KdV or a Boussinesq. We're not doing that because to do that, if we wanted to have a Hamiltonian system here, we would need to include sort of epsilon to the six terms into our equations. It would not be epsilon independent any longer. So it's a different method. So here we're truncating only in size, but over here you could truncate the Hamiltonian and get a different set of equations. It's a sort of different way to do it. But the point is, the thing that we did differently is that we didn't want to get rid of KdV, right? You would lose KdV if you wanted to have an energy-preserving higher-order system, because you would have to include it into the equation somehow. In particular, Jerry Bona is a master of coming up with sort of equations in this that sort of are like this, these sort of Hamiltonian energy conserving models. Okay, so do we actually do a better job? The answer is yeah, we do a better job. So this is the analog of the Schneider-Wayne theorem for this model. Once again, my chicken scratches on it from last time. For the good initial data that we like to consider, if we look at the real solution W, which is the same set of three functions that we had before, we subtract off KdV, we subtract off our higher order corrections, which I'm gonna. So I remember I called this combination earlier on a slide. I called this psi KdV, and so I'm gonna call U plus V, or F plus G plus B, I'm going to call that psi D or psi 2 as things go on. And so if you subtract off your higher order corrections, you improve the order by 2 powers of epsilon, which is what we expected. I should explain a little bit here about what psi D, psi Y, psi U are. Remember, remember our onthoughts was like this. So this was the onthoughts. But it was for this funny coordinate x alpha. When you go through the formal calculation, x alpha, so to highest order, minus x alpha and y look the same. They're both epsilon squared u plus v. This doesn't persist at higher orders. And so you're not going to expect to get the same thing here that you would get had you done the expansion above. But you do have a connection. You can calculate what goes order epsilon to the epsilon fourth terms here in terms of what you get here. And it's just derivatives and sums, that sort of thing. So I can tell you what that is if you would like to know. And the same thing, the same goes for the x sub t, which I call, sometimes I call u. But they're just, we know what they are, and they're not hard to compute or anything like that. They're nothing mysterious. Okay. They do not. It's the same KdV as before. They evolve independently, the same as before. Mm-hmm. Yes, it should. That's why it's not energy conserving, right? And that's why it's approximate, yeah. So, but that the size of that dispersive tail is pretty small. You'll see in a picture later on sort of how the energy not being preserved sort of maybe causing some trouble like very late in the game. So when I show you these pictures. But that's a great remark. I also am going to just show you a theorem that we proved in 2000 for the Boussinesq system, which says solutions to Boussinesq obey exactly the same estimate with exactly the same functions f, g, and p. Well, okay, I say exactly, and I'm sort of lying. It's not quite exactly. F and g satisfy linearized KdV equations with slightly different inhomogeneous terms. Nothing drastic that really changes what's going on. P also satisfies the same exact equation up to a coefficient on the inhomogeneous term. So, all right. So, doing good here. So, we have, I've talked a lot. I haven't shown as many pictures as perhaps I should. So, I'm going to show you some pictures. These are for, all these pictures are going to be from the Boussinesq equation because I'm not a good numerics guy, so doing the waterway stuff is sort of out of my ken, but the Boussinesq equation is pretty easy. To solve numerically. So I'm going to show you some simulations I ran to sort of test out how good we're doing. So this is the pictures to prove it section of the talk. So we did an experiment of a head-on collision. We did an experiment of a falling wave collision, just those two. So here's the initial setup. We have, okay, so x here is alpha. I never changed this. So this is the horizontal coordinate alpha in the Boussinesq equation, and here we have theta. So we have two KdV solitons that we, that's how we choose the initial conditions, and we run them directly at each other, and then at time, I don't even know what time this is, it's been so long since I did these numerics, we collide them. And then this picture is not very, very clear, right? It's too far out, so I'm going to zoom in on these three circled spots here. There's something funny going on up here, and then you can sort of see something developing out here that's sort of akin to the dispersive wave. So let's zoom in, and what do we see? So if we zoom in on the top, so if we zoom in, and this goes up here, KdV, so in Buzanescu equation, things sort of go the opposite way as they do in water waves. In Buzanescu, 1 plus 1 equals 2 minus epsilon. In water waves, it's 1 plus 1 equals 2 plus epsilon. That's just minor details. So KdV, this is a pure superposition, this top line. It way overshoots what you see in the Buzanescu problem. But our second order correction, you can see it's much tighter to the curve. By the way, this is epsilon equals 0.1, just in case you were wondering. If you look over here at these sort of dispersive wave-like objects, you zoom in, Buzanescu has this guy, this ripple. KdV doesn't see it at all because KdV has sort of, purely decaying solitons. And our second order correction grabs the first lobe almost indistinguishably. Okay. Out here, you can see there's a lot of difference, but at least the first chunk, it matches quite nicely. All right. So just to sort of convince you, at least try to convince you that our estimates are sort of sharp, we vary epsilon, we run this experiment over and over again, we take logs of the norms, and we plot it all, and we expect to see the slope of this curve being what we put in the theorem, so 3.5 and 5.5. So if we just run the experiment with KdV alone, we see that the error asymptotically as we decrease epsilon goes as 3.49. Like I said, I'm not a numerics guy, so I felt pretty happy about that. And then when we add in our second order correction, we got a little bit over 5.5, so that's also good. I should point out that for large values of epsilon, these things are more or less equivalent. We have a constant C, right? The error is less than C times something. Just in the interest of being honest, C is fairly large for our second order correction. It's much larger than what you would expect it to be, or what it is in the KdV approximation. So that's sort of the limit. Yeah. I'm not so happy about that, but at least it works, right? Okay. So then we did the overtaking wave collision. So before I'll just show the slide. So this little graph here. So I'm sort of zooming in. Here's the overtaking wave works like you have a big guy behind and a little guy in front. The big guy moves faster, it overtakes the little guy, and that sort of thing. This picture here is, here's the big guy and there's the little guy, and I cut it off because there's nothing interesting going on with the little guy. But he continues on. So this is more or less when things started. There's some discrepancies here, but because time has evolved a little bit. This is during the collision, right? Because when things collide in multi-solitons, they don't add up at all. They do something very nonlinear. I mean, if you wanted to show your mom what you meant by nonlinear, I think you would show them this picture. I feel like it's a linear thing's adding, and this is not linear, right? So these are not on top of each other. The KdV predicts this sort of behavior over here, and then the second order correction, the Buzanescu systems look quite close. So the weirdness of the nonlinearity during the interaction happens in both systems, but the KdV one looks notably different. And we pick that up quite nicely. And then later on, and this is a picture that's trying to show you the phase shift, if we're getting the phase shift correct, okay? So you have to sort of squint at this a little bit to see what's going on. So we have three peaks. We have this peak, and a really tall one. Right? And I'll talk about why the tall one's tall in a second. The small peak in back is the real solution to the Buzanescu problem, okay? The KDV is the small one that's out in front. And you can see if the KDV approximation had gotten the phase shift correct, they should have been right on top of one another. But it didn't get it. It didn't get it correct. KDV is now out in front of Boussinesq because it got the phase shift incorrectly. Now, our second order correction seems to be dragging back the peak a little bit, so getting the phase shift a little bit more accurate. But we've added all this extra stuff in, and that's tall. And that's because it's not energy conserving. That's where things like problems with dispersed tails and whatnot, that energy's got to go somewhere, and it goes into here, roughly. So that's this situation. This is very late in the game. This is, at the epsilon to the minus 3 sort of time scale. Okay. So I don't have any pictures for the full waterway problem, and I'm sort of running out of time anyway. But we're working on it right now, so I'll just sort of tell you where we're going. Like I said, Joe Hammack and Diane Henderson have run these really nice experiments with overtaking waves and also head-on collisions in an actual water tank. And we're running our numerics right now, solving our problems to see how well we actually do versus some physical data. And Philippe Guyen of McMaster, another postdoc, is solving the water wave equation sort of numerically, and we're going to compare with that too. So it's sort of trying to get a broad view of things that are happening. And I guess that's where we are, and that's what we're doing next. And thank you for your attention.